This is Precepts Audio Message PA-240. Nathan C. Johnson, Bible Teacher. For all those who love our Lord Jesus Christ in truth.
We are discussing the feasts of the Lord. And the first feast we discussed was the Passover. And we saw that there are certain chapters in the Old Testament, particularly in the law, like Exodus chapter 23 and chapter 12, chapter 34, Leviticus chapter 23, Numbers chapter 28, Deuteronomy chapter 16. And those chapters generally seem to set forth various aspects of these various feasts. Now, they don't all set forth parts of all of them, but we look at those portions, they'll set them forth for us. Now, the last time we had examined the Feast of Unleavened Bread, finished examining the Feast of Unleavened Bread that was associated with the Passover. Then we looked at the Feast of First Fruits. And we saw that first fruits, at first, no specific commands were given, just the fact that they were going to bring in the first fruits of their land when they got to the land. Then in Exodus 34, it talked about the Feast of Weeks, but it didn't say when the Feast of Weeks was going to start. Leviticus 2 gave a first fruits offering, but it gave no instructions as to which day to offer it. Then Leviticus 23 told them that when they were to give this first fruits offering was when they would reap the harvest of the land. And they were also supposed to give it on the day after the Sabbath. And they were not to eat of their harvest until that first fruits festival had been performed. In Numbers 18, we learned that the first fruits were given to the Aaronic priests. Numbers 28, as it always does, it gave the special sacrifices for first fruits. And then as we examined first fruits elsewhere in the Old Testament, we saw in 2 Kings 4, a man from the northern kingdom brought his first fruits to Elisha, the prophet. Of course, in the northern kingdom, they had been cut off from going to the temple. So he brought his first fruits to Elisha instead. We saw in Nehemiah that the people agreed to bring their first fruits offering to the temple in Nehemiah 10. And in Nehemiah 13, Nehemiah assigned the priests and Levites to their duties, one of which was bringing in the first fruits offering. And then in Ezekiel 44, we saw that the priests will receive the first fruits in the kingdom as well. So that was what we had discussed last time, and that brings us up to considering the first fruits offering in the New Testament. Now, there are no direct references to the Feast of First Fruits in the New Testament. And the first fruits are mentioned, but they seem to be used for other things. Specifically, they are used figuratively for men. For example, we have Romans chapter 8 and verse 23. Where it says, "And not they only, but ourselves also, which have the first fruits of the Spirit. Even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting for the adoption, to wit, the redemption of our bodies." So he talks about having the first fruits of the Spirit. And then in Romans 11:16, "For if the first fruit be holy, the lump is also holy, and if the root be holy, so are the branches." So he talks about the first fruits of Israel, and in 16:5, we have it similarly, where he says, "Likewise greet the church that is in their house, salute my well-beloved Epaphras, who is the first fruits of Achaia unto Christ." So again, we see now here this man is put symbolically for first fruits. Elsewhere, we have in 1 Corinthians 15:20 and 23, in 1 Corinthians 16:15, James 1:18, and Revelation 14:4. In all those places we have first fruits mentioned, but it's not the Feast of First Fruits. It's just mentioning first fruits. However, I would say that I don't think that means that first fruits is not mentioned in the New Testament. I think it is. And I think it is mentioned under the phrase that we have translated in our English Bibles typically as first day of the week. Now, what we have translated as first day of the week in the Greek reads one of the Sabbaths. But I believe that that refers to first fruits, as is related to the Feast of Weeks, as we'll see when we study the Feast of Weeks next. So I believe that first fruits is referenced in Matthew chapter 28 and verse 1. Matthew 28, verse 1, it says, "In the end of the Sabbath, as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week, came Mary Magdalene and the other Mary to see the sepulcher." Now, what we have translated here, first day of the week, is actually in Greek, one of the Sabbaths. And what we need to realize, and this is a little bit ahead of time because we haven't actually gotten to it yet, the Feast of Weeks, is that the Feast of First Fruits was the first day for counting to the Feast of Weeks. Now, the Feast of Weeks took place 50 days after the Feast of First Fruits. And the Feast of First Fruits was always on a Sunday, was always on the day after the Sabbath. And the Feast of Weeks was always on the day after the Sabbath. So it was always on day 50. If you counted First Fruits as day 1, the Feast of Weeks was always on day 50. So the day of first fruits was actually day 1 for counting the 7 Sabbaths to the Feast of Weeks. Or as it's called in the New Testament, the Feast of Pentecost, which is just means the 50th day. So I believe when it says that it was on one of the Sabbaths when Christ rose from the dead, that's not a phrase meaning, oh, on some generic Sabbath. On some Sabbath he rose from the dead, who knows which one. No, it's actually being very specific and saying it happened on day 1 of the days for counting the seven Sabbaths. Now, as I have explained elsewhere, I don't think it actually was a Sabbath when the Lord rose from the dead, and that was because the women were bringing the spices to decorate his body. And Luke tells us at the end of Luke chapter 23 specifically that the women rested on the Sabbath day according to the commandment. They weren't going to break the Sabbath commandment and decorate his body on the Sabbath day, so they were coming on Sunday, the day after the Sabbath. So I believe that even though it calls it one of the Sabbaths, what it actually is saying is it was day 1 for counting the 7 Sabbaths until you got to weeks. So I believe that the Lord actually rose from the dead on first fruits. And he became, as 1 Corinthians 15 says, and that was one of those passages that I said mentioned first fruits, not the festival of first fruits, but just first fruits. In 1 Corinthians 15, 20, it says, "But now is Christ risen from the dead and become the first fruits of them that slept." So Christ is the first fruits of those who rose from the dead, and how appropriate if he rose on first fruits. Well, I believe he did. So that was when the women came to the tomb, day 1 of counting the 7 Sabbaths, or just one of the Sabbaths, is how they put it for short in the Greek. We have the same thing in Mark 16:2, where it says, "And very early in the morning, one of the Sabbaths, they came unto the sepulcher at the rising of the sun." So it's not the first day of the week, it's one of the Sabbaths. Then Mark 16 and verse 9, it says, "Now when Jesus was risen early, the first of the Sabbaths, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had cast 7 devils." Here the phrase is slightly different. It actually reads the first of the Sabbaths rather than one of the Sabbaths. But again, it says he rose from the dead on the first of the Sabbaths. And again, I think that means the first day, which was actually a Sunday, for counting 49 days or 7 weeks, 7 Sabbath days until you get to Feast of Weeks. So the first of those days is actually always a Sunday. It's always the day after the Sabbath, and that's when Christ rose. We get the same thing in Luke chapter 24 and verse 1, where it says, "Now upon one of the Sabbaths, very early in the morning, they came unto the sepulcher, bringing the spices which they had prepared and certain others with them." And again, I think one of the Sabbaths means the first day for counting the 7 Sabbaths, which was a Sunday. And if we look back just one verse to Luke 50, or 23:56, we'd see what I say is the proof that this was not actually a Sabbath day, when it says they returned and prepared spices and ointments and rested the Sabbath day according to the commandment. So I don't believe, remember, there are no chapter breaks when Luke was originally writing. I don't believe he said in one verse they rested on the Sabbath day, and then in the next verse they came to decorate his body on the Sabbath day. That doesn't make any sense. So I think one of the Sabbaths means first fruits, and it was always on the day after the Sabbath, not the Sabbath day. Then we have John 20 in verse 1. Again, the exact same thing. One of the Sabbaths cometh Mary Magdalene early, when it was yet dark, unto the sepulchre, and seeth the stone taken away from the sepulchre. Again, I believe that one of the Sabbaths there is a reference to the first day for counting to the Feast of Weeks, which is actually the day of first fruits. And then verse 19 of John 20, then the same day at evening, being one of the Sabbaths, when the doors were shut where the disciples were assembled for fear of the Jews, came Jesus, and stood in the midst, and saith unto them, Peace be unto you. So it was that same day at evening, which, of course, when the sun set, they no longer counted it the same day, so this would have been probably between 5 and 6, just before sunset, when the Lord came and appeared to them. Then we have it in Acts chapter 20 and verse 7. We have this same phrase that I believe refers to first fruits. I'm going to read verse 6 because we have an important point here. But let's read verse 7 first just to see the reference. It says, and upon one of the Sabbaths, when the disciples came together to break bread, Paul proclaimed unto them, ready to depart on the morrow, and continued his speech until midnight. So, this was upon one of the Sabbaths at Troas. Paul is journeying back toward Jerusalem. He stops off at Troas, and he is there on one of the Sabbaths. In other words, on the day of first fruits, he's at Troas. Well, first fruits was not one of the days when all the Jews were supposed to go to Jerusalem, so Paul could be wherever he wanted on that day. But if we look back at verse 6, it says, and we sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread, and came unto them to Troas in 5 days, where we abode 7 days. So notice here, and this is something we need to pay attention to, because we realize that, as I hopefully made a good case for, the Lord died on Passover day. They would eat the Passover from sunset to sunrise. But to them, the same day between sunrise and sunset is when Christ died on the cross. It was on Passover day, after Passover night, that he died. And then 3 days later, when he rose from the dead, was actually the Feast of First Fruits. So that means the Feast of First Fruits was actually that year in the middle of the week of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And the Jews today, in order to make things easier, have made it so it's always that way. So first fruits is always the Sunday during unleavened bread. That's the day they celebrate first fruits. Well, that's just fine when first fruits is disassociated from any real harvest. But as I've said, how can you possibly set a date for when you're going to bring in the first crops of your harvest? You can't set such a date. You don't know that your crops are always going to come in the same time every year. Not to mention, like I said, since their calendar was actually on lunar months, and so every few years they'd have an intercalary month and add a 13th month of their year, that would mean that their dates were varying wildly by multiple weeks. Not to mention, harvest can vary wildly by multiple weeks. You can't possibly set the date for a harvest festival on your calendar. Not if you're really going to bring in the first of your crops on that date. And so here we see that they had the days of unleavened bread. Then they traveled to Troas. That was a 5-day journey. Then they stayed at Troas for 7 days. So now we are 12 days later. And then 12 days after unleavened bread comes the day of first fruits, one of the Sabbaths. Well, that's understandable when we're based on the harvest. This year, harvest didn't come in till 2 weeks after unleavened bread, 2 weeks after the Sunday that would have been during unleavened bread. Whereas the year Christ died, it came in that same week as when they were celebrating unleavened bread. Well, that's the way it is when you've got lunar months changing your calendar, and when you're basing everything on a harvest, which doesn't always come in at the same time every year. So what the Jews do now, just set it on their calendar. They didn't do when this was actually a real harvest festival. They couldn't do it that way. They had to do it according to when the harvest actually happened. So in Acts, we see that it was 2 weeks later. And then we have 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 2. Is our last reference to this one of the Sabbaths, which I believe is a reference to the Feast of First Fruits. 1 Corinthians 16:2. Upon one of the Sabbaths, let every one of you lay by him in store, as God hath prospered him, that there be no gatherings when I come. So Paul, as he often did among the nations where he was ministering, he often took collections to take back with him to the impoverished saints in Jerusalem. And that was according to his policy, that as the Jews outside the land were sharing in the spiritual blessings with the Jews inside the land, so it was only right that they share their material blessings with the generally much poorer Jews inside the land. So Paul has boasted to other groups of believers how generous the Corinthians have promised to be. And he wants to see to it that when he comes to them to actually make the collection, they actually prove to be as generous as they said they were going to be in advance, and not shame both Paul and themselves. So he advises them to set by in store on one of the Sabbaths, the way God has prospered him, so that when Paul comes, he doesn't have to go around taking collections then. Now this verse has been used by the churches many times to tell people that they need to set aside their tithes and offerings on Sunday and put their tithes and offerings into the offering plate, because you have to set aside on the first day of the week. And of course they tell them you have to set aside your tithe before you pay anything else, before you do anything else with your money. You have to set aside your tithe from your paycheck and that sort of thing. Well, Paul wasn't talking about giving something every Sunday. He was talking about setting aside on one of the Sabbaths. And this would be when your crops came in, when much of your wealth was collected, at least as a farmer. So those who were farmers among the Corinthians, this would be the time to separate out whatever they had promised. Of course, if they sold some of their grain to turn it into money, because Paul probably isn't going to carry hundreds of sacks of grain back to Jerusalem. So they would be selling it to turn it into money, but then they would set that aside and have it all ready when Paul came. So this has nothing to do with setting something aside every Sunday on a weekly basis, but this was a one-day-a-year thing, one of the Sabbaths. But it was very convenient, since it was connected with the harvest, when their wealth would be coming in, that would be the time they would set aside the money they had promised for this collection Paul was making for the poor saints in Jerusalem. So yet another verse that the churches use to their own advantage that I don't think is actually talking about what they make it to be talking about. So that, I think, is first fruits in the New Testament. It's never actually called first fruits, but I think it's found in this phrase, one of the Sabbaths, that I think is referring to it as the first day for counting the 7 weeks, the 7 Sabbaths, until the much more important Feast of Weeks. And it was more important because that was one of the three when they all had to appear at Jerusalem. Next is the Feast of Weeks. Exodus chapter 23. Now this is, again, a list of all the feasts that you had to appear before the Lord in. Remember, he said in verse 14, 3 times thou shalt keep a feast unto me in the year. Thou shalt keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And then we can skip what it says about that down to verse 16. And the Feast of Harvest, the first fruits of thy labors, which thou hast sown in the field, and the Feast of Ingathering, which is in the end of the year, when thou hast gathered in thy labors out of the field. So here we see what happened in Israel and wouldn't really happen in a climate like what we would experience here where I live in Minnesota. And that is that they would have winter crops, which would go through the rainy season, and you'd harvest them in the spring. And then you'd have your hot weather crops that would go through the hot, dry months of the summer, and you'd harvest them in the fall. And so you could have a spring harvest festival and a fall harvest one. But here, the Feast of Harvest, the first fruits of thy labors, is actually not a reference to the Feast of First Fruits, because, of course, that was not one where they were all supposed to appear at Jerusalem. For one thing, because you would only know about it a couple days in advance, there wouldn't even be time for word to go out. Not to mention for everybody to get ready to come to Jerusalem. But this is actually the feast 50 days later, as we'll see. But notice that it's called the Feast of Harvest, the First Fruits of Thy Labors. So this Feast of Weeks actually is connected with First Fruits, not only because it's counted from First Fruits, but also because there is also a first fruits offering at the Feast of Harvest. So we keep that in mind. There's actually a first fruits at first fruits, and then there's a first fruits at weeks as well. And I think it's very interesting when it comes to resurrection. In 1 Corinthians 15:20, it talks about Christ being the first fruits. But then in 1 Corinthians 15:23, there is a company of those who are resurrected in Christ who are called first fruits. So, the same thing as was in Israel, there was a first fruits and then a first fruits. As you see, the same thing in resurrection, we have Christ the first fruits and then the first fruits, resurrection company in Christ. Then in Exodus 34, we have our next mention of weeks. And here we get it by its proper name, rather than calling it the Feast of Harvest, like it did in chapter 23. In Exodus 34:22, it says, "And thou shalt observe the feast of weeks of the first fruits of wheat harvest and the feast of ingathering at the year's end." So this is the first reference to it as the Feast of Weeks. And it is given again as one of the three times they were to appear before the Lord. Verse 23, "Thrice in the year shall all your men children appear before the Lord God, the God of Israel." So notice this, that it was at the Feast of Weeks that they were to bring their first fruits in. Now, the first fruits offering was just when they took that wave sheaf and waved it before the Lord. And until they did that, nobody could eat from the harvest. So they did that right away. But then 50 days later, when the harvest would have been over, of course, then all the Israelites are supposed to bring the first fruits of their harvest to the Lord for one of the three yearly festivals. Now, you obviously couldn't right in the middle of harvest drop everything, run a several days journey to Jerusalem to carry your first fruits there, then run back and try to finish your harvest before everything gets too old on the plants. So they'd actually, most of the people would bring their first fruits in at weeks. It was only at Jerusalem, of course, near Jerusalem, that they needed to find a sheaf of the first fruits to wave before the Lord. Everybody else brought their first fruits at the Feast of Weeks. So that we see that in verse 26. "The first of the first fruits of thy land thou shalt bring unto the house of the Lord thy God. Thou shalt not see the kid in his mother's milk." So when did they bring it? Did they bring it at first fruits? No, they brought it at the Feast of Weeks. And when they came, they not only brought their first fruits, but they were also supposed to bring something else. As it says in verse 20, "None shall appear before me empty." So we've talked about this before. When they came these three times, they were supposed to bring the Lord an offering over and above the expected offering, over and above the first fruits. They were also supposed to bring a gift for the Lord. He didn't specify what, because it was up to them, and it was also up to how much they had. Maybe all they could afford is a drink offering. Well, that's all they could afford. The Lord would accept that. Maybe they're quite wealthy, and they bring a bullock or bring an ox. Well, that's fine. If they're wealthy and they can afford that and they want to give the Lord the most expensive gift possible, they could do that. But they had to bring something to him when they appeared. Now, Leviticus 23, all we had in Exodus was that it's called the Feast of Weeks, but why it's called the Feast of Weeks or how you figure out when it is was not mentioned. But in Leviticus 23, which is the first time we have a really formal setting forth of all the feasts, in fact, it is the passage that formally sets forth all the feasts. Here is finally where we have the instructions for counting the weeks. So Leviticus chapter 23 and verse 15. So remember, we just got done learning about the first fruits with its wave sheaf offering in verses 9 through 14. And then it says in verse 15, "And ye shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath." Of course, that was first fruits, always on the day after the Sabbath. "From the day that ye brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be complete." So here he says 7 Sabbaths. Of course, 7 Sabbaths is 7 weeks, so 49 days. So he says, "Even the morrow after the 7th Sabbath," so that would be day 50, "shall ye number 50 days. And ye shall offer a new meat offering unto the Lord. Ye shall bring out of your habitations 2 wave loaves of 2/10 deals. They shall be a fine flour, they shall be baken with leaven, they are the first fruits unto the Lord. And ye shall offer with the bread 7 lambs without blemish of the first year, and 1 young bullock, and 2 rams. They shall be for a burnt offering unto the Lord, with their meal offering and their drink offerings, even an offering made by fire of sweet savour unto the Lord. Then ye shall sacrifice 1 kid of the goats for a sin offering, and 2 lambs of the first year for a sacrifice of peace offerings. And the priest shall wave them with the bread of the first fruits for a wave offering before the Lord with the 2 lambs. They shall be holy to the Lord for the priest. And ye shall proclaim on the selfsame day that it may be an holy convocation unto you. Ye shall do no servile work therein. It shall be a statute forever in all your dwellings throughout your generations." So here we see how they were to count the weeks. They were to count it from first fruits. They were to count 7 Sabbaths. And then the day after the Sabbath, the 50th day, was the Feast of Weeks. And there was a second first fruits offering made then by the priest, as well as we saw back in Exodus 34, that was when all the people brought their first fruits into the temple for the priests. Now it also includes a provision for the poor, is included right here in verse 22. "And when ye reap the harvest of your land, thou shalt not make clean riddance of the corners of thy field when thou reapest. Neither shalt thou gather any gleaning of thy harvest. Thou shalt leave them unto the poor and to the stranger. I am the Lord your God." So provision for the priests was made by first fruits, because all the Israelites would bring their first fruits to Jerusalem and then would be distributed to the priests. But also provision was made for the poor in the harvest, and he said, "Don't harvest the corners of your field." But this was the Feast of Weeks. Now, Numbers 28. And remember, in Numbers, Leviticus 23 is formally setting forth all the feasts. Numbers 28 is setting forth the special sacrifices that are supposed to take place during each feast. And there were special sacrifices that only took place on those days. Now, Numbers 28, verse 26 says, "Also in the day of the first fruits, when ye bring a new meal offering unto the Lord, after your weeks be out, ye shall have an holy convocation, ye shall do no servile work." So notice this, this calls it the day of first fruits. So the first thing that flashes to our mind is, oh, the feast of first fruits. But then, no, he's saying after your weeks, the first fruits after your weeks. So notice here it even calls the Feast of Weeks a day of first fruits. So both the Feast of First Fruits and the Feast of Weeks are days of first fruits. So we have to keep those things straight. So that is a Sabbath. They do no work on that day. Of course, the first fruits was not a Sabbath. That was because it was right during harvest. The Lord isn't going to make them take 2 days off instead of one, right in the middle of harvest. But this one is a Sabbath. He says, "But ye shall offer the burnt offering for a sweet savour unto the Lord. 2 young bullocks, 1 ram, 7 lambs of the first year, and their meal offering of flour mingled with oil, 3 tenth deals unto 1 bullock, 2 tenth deals unto 1 ram, a several tenth deal unto 1 lamb throughout the 7 lambs, and one kid of the goats to make an atonement for you. You shall offer them beside the continual burnt offering and his meal offering. They shall be unto you without blemish, and their drink offerings. So there he lists the special sacrifices on top of the daily sacrifices, and mentions that it was a Sabbath day. Then finally, Deuteronomy chapter 16. We look at what Deuteronomy 16 has to say about the Feast of Weeks. And Deuteronomy being, of course, the Greek word Deuteronomy means second law, or second giving of the law, but we don't believe that God was just repeating himself, but he was actually relating the law to them under the new relationship they had to it now that they had broken their covenant with the Lord. And they now had a new relationship with the law under the broken covenant. But in Deuteronomy 16 and verse 9, it sets forth the Feast of Weeks. When it says, 7 weeks shalt thou number unto thee. Begin to number the 7 weeks from such time as thou beginnest to put the sickle to the corn. So notice, again, that this feast is not one you could ever possibly put on your calendar because it starts from harvest. And you can't schedule harvest on your calendar. In verse 10, and thou shalt keep the Feast of Weeks unto the Lord thy God with a tribute of a freewill offering of thine hand, which thou shalt give unto the Lord thy God according as the Lord thy God hath blessed thee. So here he emphasizes that they are to bring a gift when they come for the Feast of Weeks. Then verse 11, and thou shalt rejoice before the Lord thy God, thou and thy son and thy daughter, and thy manservant and thy maidservant, and the Levite that is within thy gates, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow that are among you in the place which the Lord thy God hath chosen to place his name there. And thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman in Egypt, and thou shalt observe and do these statutes. So notice that this is a festival of rejoicing. I believe it was rejoicing in the harvest brought in. And it's the same thing with our Thanksgiving festival. Thanksgiving is after we've generally all brought in the harvest. Once your harvest is in, then you rejoice in it and enjoy it. You don't want to take time out to rejoice while you're busy doing the harvest. So it was rejoicing in the harvest the Lord had given them, and also rejoicing in the fact that they were in their own land, they had their own land, they had their own crops, they had their own lands, they were no longer slaves in Egypt. And then in Deuteronomy 16 and verse 16, we have one more mention of this feast in connection with the three feasts. When it says, verse 16, three times in a year shall all thy males appear before the Lord thy God in the place which he shall choose. In the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and in the Feast of Weeks, and in the Feast of Tabernacles, and they shall not appear before the Lord empty. Every man shall give as he is able, according to the blessing of the Lord thy God, which he hath given thee. So here he sets it forth very clearly that what was called the Feast of Harvest, as the second of the three yearly feasts in Exodus 23:16, is the Feast of Weeks, as it calls it here in Deuteronomy 16:16. So it was the second of the feasts that they were to appear before the Lord at Jerusalem. Now notice that it was the only feast they were to appear before the Lord that was a one-day feast. Of course, Passover you'd go there, and that was a single day, but you're really going there for unleavened bread, which was 7 days. The Feast of Tabernacles, you'd go there for another festival of 7 days, but Feast of Weeks was only a single day. So you'd go take that long trip to Jerusalem, celebrate there for 1 day, and then take the trip back. Well, of course, it wasn't long for everybody, depending on how far you live from Jerusalem, but it was just to be a single day. Well, you could stay there longer if you want. You could get there early if you want. It's just you had to be there on that day. Well, where do we have the Feast of Weeks elsewhere in the Old Testament? Well, first of all, we have it in 2 Chronicles chapter 8. Verse 13. So this is talking about Solomon starting to set up the offerings at the temple. And it says, even after a certain rate every day, offerings according to the commandment of Moses, on the Sabbaths and on the new moons and on the solemn feasts 3 times in the year, even the Feast of Unleavened Bread and in the Feast of Weeks and in the Feast of Tabernacles. So Solomon here is appointing and offering the special sacrifices, both the regular sacrifices. So he has the daily sacrifices, the special sacrifices on the Sabbath, special sacrifices on the new moons, the first days of the month, and then the special sacrifices on the solemn feasts, particularly the three during the year, one of which is the Feast of Weeks, is the second one. And there's only one other time that we might have a reference to the Feast of Weeks elsewhere in the Old Testament. That's Jeremiah chapter 5 and verse 24. Although it's kind of an oblique reference, if it is a reference. Jeremiah 5:24 says, "Neither say they in their heart, Let us now fear the Lord our God, that giveth rain, both the former and the latter rain in the season. He reserveth unto us the appointed weeks of the harvest." So here he mentions the appointed weeks of the harvest. Well, might just be mentioning that he is providing the harvest for them. He's reserving the harvest for them, just like he's giving rain in the season that's needed for the harvest. But it could also be a reference possibly to the Feast of Weeks. But that's hard to say. So there really isn't a whole lot of reference to it elsewhere in the Old Testament. But then we get to other references to weeks in the New Testament. Well, we don't have any in the Gospels, but we do have in the book of Acts. Of course, the most famous, for us anyway, of all the Feast of Weeks festivals in Acts chapter 2. Acts chapter 2 and verse 1 says, "And when the day of Pentecost was fully come, they were all with one accord in one place. And suddenly there came a sound from heaven as of a rushing mighty wind, and it filled all the house where they were sitting." So this was on Pentecost. Now Pentecost in Greek just means the 50th day. And it was the name in Greek for the Feast of Weeks. And we see there was on this day of Pentecost that the Holy Spirit was first poured out at the start of the kingdom. So we had Christ died on Passover, Christ rose on first fruits, and the Holy Spirit was poured out for the first time on Pentecost. So we see how the Lord is using these feasts for special events in the New Testament. And this has led me to wonder what other special events might take place on some of the other feasts. And the next one after weeks is trumpets. And that has led me to wonder, could it be that the kingdom of God, the manifest kingdom, will actually start on the Feast of Trumpets, since it would be the next one in line to have a significant event take place on it? Well, of course, that's just speculation, but around the end of September every year, I kind of think about that. Because I think, I think that's the most likely time for the kingdom of God to start is on the Feast of Trumpets. But that's not to say that I know for sure it's going to start then by any means. But at any rate, here on the Feast of Weeks, the Holy Spirit is poured out in the first great manifestation of the kingdom. Now, Acts chapter 20 and verse 16 again, Acts chapter 20, we have Paul is heading back for Jerusalem. And it tells us, "For Paul had determined to sail by Ephesus, because he would not spend the time in Asia, for he hasted, if it were possible for him, to be at Jerusalem the day of Pentecost." And so he was heading for Jerusalem, and he wanted to be there, if it was at all possible, on the day of Pentecost, because, of course, that was one of the 3 days when every Israelite was supposed to try to be in Jerusalem if he could. Now, I believe that Paul had actually taken a vow to be in Jerusalem on Pentecost. We see that in Acts 18:18, that he had to shave his head in Centuria, for he had a vow. Apparently he had touched a dead body and therefore had desecrated the hair of his vow, so he had to shave it off, start the vow over at Centuria. Normally you do that at the temple, but Paul was way too far from the temple to carry it out properly. And I believe he did arrive at Jerusalem in time for Pentecost, because he was fulfilling his vow in chapter 21 when he was arrested in the temple. So Paul was anxious to keep the Feast of Pentecost in Jerusalem, showing that he was still keeping the law in Acts chapter 20. And we had not yet gotten to the dispensation of grace in the time when law keeping is no longer important. Then we have 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 8. Here's our last reference to it. Paul speaking to Corinthians about his future travels. He's hoping to come to see them again. But he tells them in 1 Corinthians 16:8, but I will tarry at Ephesus until Pentecost. So Paul being a Jew, his readers in Corinth being Jews, they all were familiar with the Jewish feasts. And so to say, I'll stay here until after Pentecost is just like if I said, I won't come until after Christmas. And we're all aware of Christmas. It's just it marks time for us, or after the new year marks time for us. After the 4th of July, so forth, we can use these holidays to mark time. Not necessarily actually referring to the holiday, but you're just using it to mark time. And that's what Paul is mentioning. Now notice that Paul is going to be at Ephesus, not at Jerusalem at Pentecost. And you'd say, well, he's not keeping the law. Well, remember, the Lord gave the exception for if you're on a journey. He said anyone who's not on a journey and fails to keep the Passover should be cut off from Israel. But Paul is on a journey, and not only is he on a journey, he's on a journey that the Lord sent him on to go out and proclaim the gospel around the world. So he certainly has permission to miss the feasts since he is on a journey for the Lord. Well, that is all we have for references to the Feast of Weeks, as it's called Pentecost in the New Testament. But there is one more passage worth mentioning in connection with the Feast of First Fruits and the Feast of Weeks, and that is Luke chapter 6 and verse 1. In Luke chapter 6 and verse 1, it says, "And it came to pass on the second Sabbath after the first that he went through the cornfields, and his disciples plucked the ears of corn and did eat, rubbing them in their hands." So this says, the second Sabbath after the first. And what the Greek actually reads is the second first Sabbath. Now, what exactly this means is somewhat difficult. And Bullinger thinks that it means the first of two Sabbaths on a feast week, when there would be two Sabbaths on the same week. Well, that could be, but I also wonder if it has something to do with, it could be that it has something to do with the second Sabbath for counting the seven Sabbaths to Pentecost. Well, that was my thought. Bullinger thinks it means it's referring to one of those weeks where there's multiple Sabbaths because of feast Sabbaths. Who knows for sure? But definitely the second Sabbath, or the second first Sabbath, is some special day and not just a typical Sabbath. And they've translated it in our King James, the second Sabbath after the first. Well, if you put it that way, it sounds like it's talking about the second Sabbath, counting the Feast of Weeks. But modern scholars tend to assign it to the second of the unleavened bread Sabbaths. So it's only a guess if we think it's the second to the Feast of Weeks. So that's the Feast of Weeks in the rest of the Old Testament and the New Testament. Well, next feast we have is the Feast of Trumpets. And the Feast of Trumpets is not actually mentioned in Exodus. So, one of the least mentioned feasts. It isn't actually mentioned until Leviticus 23, when we're getting the formal outline of all the feasts. So Leviticus chapter 23 and verse 23 is actually the first time that the Feast of Trumpets is mentioned. So Leviticus 23:23, it says, "And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, saying, In the seventh month, in the first day of the month, shall ye have a Sabbath, a memorial of blowing of trumpets, and holy convocation. Ye shall do no servile work therein, but ye shall offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord." So, the instructions for the Feast of Trumpets was that it was supposed to be on the first day of the seventh month. So this was a set-by-day feast. Again, like Passover and unleavened bread, and not a day that was dependent on something else, like first fruits and weeks, which were dependent on the harvest. Now, the reason for picking the first day of the seventh month is not super clear to us. However, it does appear that this was possibly the beginning of the Jewish year before the Lord changed the calendar. Remember, he told them in Passover month, he says, "This month is to be the first month of the year to you." Well, that would appear to be the Lord indicating that it was a change, that that wasn't the first month of the year before. And as far as we can tell, it was actually a complete half-year change, that the seventh month actually used to be the first month. And the Jews today actually do not celebrate the month in which Passover is as the first month. They actually celebrate the seventh month as the first month. So I guess they did not really go along with the Lord's changing of their calendar, at least not completely. And they call the Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year, the first day of the year, is actually the first day of what the Bible would call the seventh month. But this day, instead of the first day of the year, the Lord makes it the Feast of Trumpets. But no justification is really given as to why to celebrate this first day. And he doesn't call it the first day of the year because he's called, of course, the month that Passover is in, the first month of the year. He just says to celebrate it with the blowing of trumpets. And it was to be a Sabbath. Of course, that meant no matter what day of the week it fell on, since it was the first of the month, it could fall on any day of the week. Whatever day, it was supposed to be a Sabbath day in which they were to do no work. And there was supposed to be a special offering to the Lord made by fire on that day. And like I said, it has no signification given in the Old Testament, but I wonder if that's possibly the day on which the kingdom will begin. That would certainly be something worth blowing trumpets about. Numbers chapter 10. This does not mention specifically the Feast of Trumpets, but it talks about the making of these silver trumpets. Numbers chapter 10 and verse 1. It says, "And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Make thee two trumpets of silver. Of a whole piece shalt thou make them, that thou mayest use them for the calling of the assembly and for their journeying of the camps. And when they shall blow with them, all the assembly shall assemble themselves to thee at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation." And of course, the assembly was not every Israelite. The assembly was the kahal, the representative leaders. "And if they blow but with one trumpet, then the princes which are the heads of the thousands of Israel shall gather themselves unto thee." So if only one trumpet blows, then it's just the leader of thousands rather than the whole kahal. It says, "When you blow an alarm, then the camps that lie on the east part shall go forward. When you blow an alarm the second time, then the camps that lie on the south side shall take their journey. They shall blow an alarm for their journeys. When the congregation is to be gathered together, ye shall blow, but ye shall not sound an alarm." So apparently there were different sounds for an alarm and for not an alarm. "And the sons of Aaron the priest shall blow with the trumpets. And they shall be to you for an ordinance forever throughout your generations. And if you go to war in your land against the enemy that oppresseth you, then ye shall blow an alarm with the trumpets, and ye shall be remembered before the Lord your God, and ye shall be saved from your enemies. Also in the day of your gladness, and in your solemn days, and in the beginnings of your months ye shall blow with the trumpets, over your burnt offerings, and over the sacrifices of your peace offerings, that they may be to you for a memorial before your God. I am the Lord your God. So very interesting, in verse 10, we see that on all their solemn feast days, they blew the trumpets. Well, then you say, well, what was special about the first day of the seventh month and the Feast of Trumpets? Well, nothing much if they blew it on all their feast days. But I guess that means that the trumpets was the significant thing about that day, was the blowing of the trumpets. And notice it was also to be blown on the new moon. So the first of every month, they were to blow at the trumpets in the beginnings of your months. So it wasn't just the seventh month. Every month they blow at the trumpets. But just the seventh was apparently the most significant. Then Numbers chapter 29. We've been speaking of Numbers chapter 28 as the chapter where all the special sacrifices for the feast were set forth. But we've run out of chapter 28. And it spills over into chapter 29 for our next feast. Numbers chapter 29 and verse 1. It says, "And in the seventh month, on the first day of the month, ye shall have an holy convocation. Ye shall do no servile work. It is a day of blowing the trumpets unto you. And ye shall offer a burnt offering for a sweet savour unto the Lord, one young bullock, one ram, and seven lambs of the first year without blemish. And their meat offering shall be of flour mingled with oil, 3/10 deals for a bullock, and 2/10 deals for a ram, and 1/10 deal for one lamb throughout the seven lambs, and 1 kid of the goats for a sin offering to make an atonement for you, beside the burnt offering of the month, and his meal offering, and the daily burnt offering, and his meal offering, and their drink offerings, according unto their manner, for a sweet savour, a sacrifice made by fire unto the Lord." Again, it mentions the first day of the seventh month. It mentions that it is a holy convocation in which no work is to be done. It mentions it's a day of blowing of trumpets. And then it gives the special sacrifices over and above the daily sacrifices that are to be performed on that day. And these were also offered over and above the normal new moon sacrifices, because there were special sacrifices on every new moon, on every first of the month. But these were special over and beyond that. Now, are there trumpets elsewhere in the Old Testament? Well, not really. The mentions of the Feast of Trumpets are pretty few. It's only mentioned a few times, not given much significance. However, there are priests bearing trumpets mentioned. Well, but again, they're supposed to bear them when they go to war and so forth, so there's no particular reference to this day there. However, there is one reference to the first day of the seventh month, and that is in the book of Ezra, chapter 3. So in Ezra 3 and verse 6, it says, "From the first day of the seventh month began they to offer burnt offerings unto the Lord. But the foundation of the temple of the Lord was not yet laid." So here we learn that the sacrifices at the temple, even though they hadn't started building the temple yet, they set up the altar and started offering the daily sacrifices again on the first day of the seventh month. So that actually the Feast of Trumpets was the first day that sacrifices were offered at the temple site at the time of the building of Zerubbabel's temple, or Ezra's temple. So that's really the only time outside the law when the day is mentioned, and it isn't even specifically mentioned as being the day of trumpets, just that that's the day when they started offering sacrifices again after the temple was destroyed. Well, what about trumpets in the New Testament then? Well, again, the Feast of Trumpets is not specifically mentioned in the New Testament. However, there are significant events in the New Testament connected with the blowing of trumpets. First of all, in 1 Corinthians 15, in verse 52, when Paul says in verse 51, "Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump. For the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed." I believe this is something that's going to happen at the start of the kingdom. And notice that the great resurrection here, of at least the Acts period believers, that it takes place with the sounding of a trumpet. So could it be that this day, the day when the people are raised and the kingdom begins, could it be that it actually will happen on the Feast of Trumpets? And then in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, again we have in verse 15, "For this we say unto you by the word of the Lord, that we which are alive and remain unto the coming of the Lord shall not prevent them which are asleep. For the Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trump of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so shall we ever be with the Lord." So here the Lord's parousia starts with the sound of a trumpet. So could it be that the parousia too starts in the Feast of the Trumpets? Well, if I had to guess, I'd actually guess that the parousia starts in the Feast of Tabernacles. Because, of course, that's the time when Christ comes to earth and starts tabernacling among us. But, with a reference to the trumpets, it could also be that it starts on trumpets. Who knows? But there's no real references to trumpets in the New Testament or anywhere outside the law. It's a feast that's mentioned only very briefly and not really explained. And we'll have to wait for further light from the Lord on the significance of it. Our next feast is known as the Fast or the Day of Atonement. And to see it from the law, we turn to Leviticus chapter 23. Leviticus 23 and verse 26. And again, here we have the formal setting forth of all the feasts. It says, "And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Also on the 10th day of this 7th month, there shall be a day of atonement. It shall be an holy convocation unto you, and ye shall afflict your souls, and offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord. And ye shall do no work in that same day, for it is a day of atonement, to make an atonement before you, before the Lord your God. For whatsoever soul it be that shall not be afflicted in that same day, he shall be cut off from among his people. And whatsoever soul it be that doeth any work in that same day, the same soul will I destroy from among his people. He shall do no manner of work. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwellings. It shall be unto you a Sabbath of rest, and ye shall afflict your souls. In the 9th day of the month at even, from even unto even, shall ye celebrate your Sabbath." So, this is instructions for the Day of Atonement. He says, this is the Day of Atonement. It's another holy convocation. It's another Sabbath day in which they were to do no work. And this particular Sabbath, if anybody did do any work, the Lord says that he himself would destroy that one from among his people. Well, we've noticed we've had a lot of feast Sabbaths and none have been set forth so solemnly as this. So apparently this was a especially important Sabbath, that the Lord himself would enforce it. Now, it says that you are to afflict your souls on that day. And your soul, in the Hebrew mindset, was the seat of emotions. And it was sometimes put for the things that would satisfy your emotions and desires, such as food. So this afflicting your soul seems to be a reference to the fact that this was a fast day, although it doesn't specifically say to fast in this passage anyway. But it does say afflict your souls. Then Leviticus chapter 25 and verse 9. Leviticus 25 is actually setting forth the Sabbath years. And then there is the Sabbath of Sabbath years, which is the Jubilee year, the 50th year. And this is really talking about the Jubilee. But in verse 9 it says, "Then shalt thou cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month. In the Day of Atonement shall you make the trumpet sound throughout all your land." So on the 49th year, which would be the year before the Jubilee year, they would sound a trumpet that would signal the upcoming Jubilee year. And the day they would blow the trumpet to signify that the upcoming year was the Jubilee year was actually the Day of Atonement. the 10th day of the 7th month. So atonement was connected with the Jubilee. Then we have it in Numbers 29, verses 7 through 11. Again, our special sacrifices in Numbers 28 and 29. There were special sacrifices on the Day of Atonement. Numbers 29 and verse 7. It says, "And ye shall have on the 10th day of this 7th month an holy convocation. And ye shall afflict your souls, ye shall not do any work therein. But ye shall offer a burnt offering unto the Lord for a sweet savour, one young bullock, one ram, and 7 lambs of the first year. They shall be unto you without blemish. And their meal offering shall be of flour mingled with oil, 3 tenth deals to a bullock, and 2 tenth deals to one ram, a several tenth deal for one lamb throughout the 7 lambs, 1 kid of the goats for a sin offering, beside the sin offering of atonement, and the continual burnt offering, and the meal offering of it, and their drink offering." So again, this is a setting forth of the sacrifices that are to take place on this special day, again, over and above the daily sacrifices. But in verse 7, again, it confirms that it is a holy convocation, in other words, a Sabbath day, on which you do no work, and also that they were to afflict their souls on that day. Again, seems to be a reference to a fast. Now, elsewhere in the Old Testament is this mentioned. Well, yes, in Isaiah chapter 58, we have a mention of this. In Isaiah 58, it says, "Cry aloud, spare not. Lift up thy voice like a trumpet, and show my people their transgression, and the house of Jacob their sins. Yet they seek me daily, and delight to know my ways, as a nation that did righteousness, and forsook not the ordinance of their God. They ask of me the ordinances of justice. They take delight in approaching to God. Wherefore have we fasted, say they, and thou seest not? Wherefore have we afflicted our soul, and thou takest no knowledge?" So notice this, that fasting and afflicting their soul is put together. So apparently that's what the Lord meant initially when he said, afflict your soul, was to fast. So he says, these people act like a people who did righteousness, in that they seek me, they delight to know me, they don't forsake my ordinances, they ask about my justice, they fast, and then they ask, why don't you pay attention to our fast? Why aren't you impressed? He says, "Behold, in the day of your fast ye find pleasure and exact all your labors." So he says, instead of afflicting your soul, of denying yourself, you take pleasure on my fast day. And instead of not working, you exact all your labors on the fast day. He says, "Behold, ye fast for strife and debate, and to smite with the fist of wickedness. Ye shall not fast as ye do this day to make your voice to be heard on high. Is it such a fast that I have chosen, a day for a man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow down his head as a bulrush, and to spread sackcloth and ashes under him? Wilt thou call this a fast, and an acceptable day to the Lord?" So if they weren't taking pleasure on this day, they were overdoing it. They were walking around with their head hanging low. They were putting on sackcloth and ashes and acting like they were in mourning. He says, that isn't what I chose either. He says, is not this the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, and to let the oppressed go free, and that ye break every yoke. Now notice here he's connecting, in many ways, this fast with Jubilee, just like he did when he said that was the day on which the trumpet to announce Jubilee was to be blown. He says, "Is it not to deal thy bread to the hungry, and that thou bring the poor that are cast out to thy house? When thou seest the naked, that thou cover him, and that thou hide not thyself from thine own flesh? Then shall thy light break forth as the morning, and thine health shall spring forth speedily, and thy righteousness shall go before thee. The glory of the Lord shall be thy rear reward. Then shalt thou call, and the Lord shall answer. Thou shalt cry, and he shall say, Here I am. If thou take away from the midst of thee the yoke, the putting forth of the finger, and speaking vanity. If thou draw out thy soul to the hungry, and satisfy the afflicted soul. Then shall thy light rise in obscurity, and thy darkness be as the noonday. And the Lord shall guide thee continually, and satisfy thy soul in drought, and make fat thy bones, and thou shalt be like a watered garden, and like a spring of water whose waters fail not. And they that shall be of thee shall build the old waste places. Thou shalt raise up the foundations of many generations, and thou shalt be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of paths to dwell in. So God's argument here is that they're not keeping the fast like he wanted it to be kept. They're keeping it with wickedness. They're either enjoying themselves or else putting on total mourning. They're not fasting to him, and he says, the fast I really want is for you to do righteousness at the same time as you're fasting, to show generosity and to fight against wickedness. That's what I want you to do on the fast day. Then in Zechariah 7, 3 and 5 and 8, 19, we have fast mentioned. And maybe you'll remember those from back when we studied Zechariah. However, I don't think they're necessarily the yearly fast. Because, as we see in Zechariah 7, 3, and speak to the priests which were in the house of the Lord of hosts, and to the prophets, saying, should I weep in the fifth month, separating myself as I have done these so many years? So this is actually speaking of a fast in the fifth month. And the same thing in verse 5, speak unto all the people of the land and to the priests, saying, when ye fasted and mourned in the fifth and seventh month, even those 70 years, did ye at all fast unto me, even to me? So he mentions a fast in the seventh month, but he says they've only been fasting in the seventh month, fifth and seventh month, for 70 years since their captivity. So it probably refers to the assassination of Gedaliah by Ishmael on the third day of the seventh month, which was a fast that they had added, and not actually the Lord's initial fast on the 10th of the month. Same thing probably in Zechariah 8:19, when the Lord mentions the fast of the seventh month. He's probably mentioning the fast on the third day, which commemorated the assassination of Gedaliah, rather than the fast on the 10th day, according to the law. What about the New Testament? Any references to the Day of Atonement in the New Testament? Well, there is one reference in Acts 27 and verse 9. That's the only real reference in the New Testament. And it's in that, using it to mark time category in Acts 27, 9, when it says, now when much time was spent, and when sailing was now dangerous, because the fast was now already past, Paul admonished them and said unto them, sirs, I perceive that this voyage will be with much hurt. So marking time by the fact that the Sabbath was past, and their seventh month would be in late September, early October. So it's already getting late toward the stormy time of year in the Mediterranean Sea. And so it would be a dangerous time to journey, and Paul advises them not to do it. And of course, they don't listen to him. So that's the only mention of the fast in the New Testament, and it's just as a reference to the time of year, which any Jew would be familiar of, that the fast took place just before the fall stormy season. So that is the fast and the Day of Atonement. And we have one major feast left of the seven feasts, Feast of Tabernacles, and we will consider that next time.